Your recordings are connected. You may now proceed.
Great. Thanks, Zach. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the GNSO Next Gen RDS PDP Working Group call on the 30th of August, 2016 at 1600 UTC. In the interest of time today, there will be no roll call, as we have quite a few participants. Attendance will be taken via the Adobe Connect room. So if you're only on the audio bridge today, would you please let yourself be known now?
Hi, everyone. Maria Lewis on the audio bridge.
Great. Thanks, Maria. I would also like to remind all participants, please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Also, keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll hand the call over to Chuck Gomes.
Welcome, everyone, to our call this week. As we end summer in the Northern Hemisphere, so looking forward to another productive meeting today. Let me, first of all, ask if anyone has a statement of interest update. Okay, not hearing or seeing anyone. Let's move on to agenda item two. It's a brief one. The final text that we agreed to on the call last week for the problem statement was distributed for everyone to see, and we don't need to go over that again. Let me just make two comments. Number one, if there's something drastically problematic in the problem statement, in the months ahead, we can always revisit that. And most importantly, the last paragraph says that the problem statement is meant as a tool to aid in discussion consistent with but not a constraint on a working group and its charter. So keep that in mind. Thanks for all the effort on that. And hopefully that'll be somewhat helpful in the work that we have ahead as we get closer to deliberation and in deliberation itself. So going then to agenda item three on the work plan status update, you can see there in the agenda there's a link to that. It has been updated to reflect the latest changes we've agreed to over the last few months. And if there are any questions on that, just send them to the list. We won't go through that right now. Later this week, we'll probably just distribute a redline version of that so that you can see the latest changes. And then next week, if there are any questions, we can discuss it again. Okay, going then to agenda item four, which is our main focus today, and that's to continue reviewing some example use cases. In that regard, before we get started with the first one from Elaine, let me say that the leadership team would like to wrap up use cases no later than our meeting next week. Again, noting that if we discover a use case that we need down the road somewhere, we can always do it. There's nothing preventing us from doing that. In fact, that would be encouraged. So it's not as if we're closing the door permanently, but for this set of meetings where we're specifically discussing use cases, we'd like to wrap that up in the meeting next week. So if there are any additional use cases to the list of fairly representative use cases that we've talked about, and you want to submit that, please do it by Friday of this week. We don't have to have any more, but if there are any that we don't cover today or that are new for our discussion, please submit them to the working group by Friday, and then be prepared to attend our working group meeting a week from now at the same time, so that you can provide an overview and answer questions. With that said, I see that Elaine would like to maybe go second or third. And if it's okay, Beth, you're on, or are you willing to go first?
Yeah, that's fine.
Good, good. That's okay, fine. Let's pull Beth up, which is number 23. And as soon as it comes up, we'll let her give us a brief
there
overview.
We go.
Go ahead.
Okay. So this is Beth Allegretti. So so this is a use case for a merger and acquisition domain name portfolio due diligence situation. So this is where company A, the acquiring company, is buying, you know, company B, the company that's being bought, and is assessing the intellectual property assets of the company B. So the RDS comes into play here when company A is confirming that domain name list and assessing the registration information and the status of every domain on the list. So what happens here, what the RDS is used for, is company A gets the list from company B. Company A accesses the RDS to find out every bit of information about all those domain names, if it's accurate, consistent, but more importantly, to find the domains that company B may not even know they own. Often, companies don't really track their domain names, or maybe there's an employee that registers a domain and forgets to tell anybody. You know, I work in the at Fox Studios, and we often have production assistants that register domain names and sort of forget to tell people. So what the RDS helps with is finding all of those domains that the company B may not even be aware of. So what company A would do is look at all the bits of information in the RDS and start doing reverse who is searches to gather up the domains that contain that information. So company A would look at registrant, organization, address, emails, servers, any bit of the information there, and then just try to pull it all together. Would also use the RDS to run wildcard searches on domains that contain the company trademarks so that the list can be pulled and then it can be assessed and verified, and that and often company B will be surprised, doesn't even know they have half of those domains. So that's the use case for a merger and acquisition. So if you're acquiring a company, the RDS is used to identify domains owned by the company that's being acquired. The stakeholders in this are, you know, registries, registrars, the third party who is providers, and the agent. So like law firms might run this instead of the actual company. And then the data elements are all the bits of data included in the RDS. So that's pretty much it. It's a pretty simple one. And that's it.
Thank you very much, Beth. This is Chuck again. So let's open it up for questions or comments. And then, Beth, you're once people ask questions, if they raise your hand, you're perfectly free to just manage the queue if you like, if they raise their hand. I think we just have one person. I think Marina's the only one that's on audio. So, Marina, if you want to say something, please speak up. So, go ahead. We'll let Michael start
Michael.
Go ahead, Beth, and respond to him directly.
Michael?
Mike, are you on mute?
No. He says no. Oh, we'll dial in. Okay.
Okay.
Maxine, let's see. Stakeholders might include registrants, staff members acting as private persons when registered domains in their own name. So is that a question, or is that a statement about the information that might be included? Oh, suggestion. Okay, thanks. Michele?
Mike Palage was ahead of me, so let him go first. Oh, he's dialing in, sorry.
I'm
kind of doing multiple things. No, I just think it's an interesting one. Whether it's interacting with the RDS or who is or whatever, as a registrar and as a hosting provider, we see this kind of thing happening both in terms of trying to help our own clients get to grips with their domains, and also when the parent companies come along and try to resolve issues. So, it is something we see quite a bit of. It does get a little bit complicated because, from our perspective, if you turned up, say, demanding that, hand over something, Fox, something, dot whatever, to us, and the domain was registered to John Murphy with an address, whatever, down the road, that could be a little bit complicated. But if the employee is cooperating and being helpful and not being a total useless waste of space, then it's not a problem. But we see a lot of this as well, where it's the employees then have a falling out with their employer and then don't want to cooperate. And we also see that happening with web designers and web developers, which makes for lots of headaches. Thanks.
Agreed. Michael, are you on?
I am now on. Thank you very much.
Okay, go on.
So it's not so much a question, perhaps just an additional contribution. So over the past 17 years in my involvement in the namespace, I have used the data in the Whois for a variety of reasons, mostly in the context of expert testimony. And Chuck, you may appreciate this from back in your NSI days. In one case, it was a merger acquisition where it was contested as to who owned the underlying domain name, which was the principal asset. And in that point in time, I actually had to work with Phil to get a subpoena to get all the old email records before you dumped them as part of your migration over to the new RDS and EPP system. So I can attest that, yes, I've used these in a number of expert testimony cases over the last 17 years. Again, they are very important, even when you may not have accurate information pointing to name servers where certain domain names may be clustered, actually goes into a number of the analytics and analysis. So I would not only say merger acquisition, but also in connection with expert testimony, where I've used this system a number of times over the years.
Great. Thanks. Andrew, your hand's up.
Yes, thank you. So I thought that was an interesting point that Michael just made, but I think it's, strictly speaking, separate from the mergers and acquisitions case, right? Because for the merger and acquisition case, an important feature here is that presumably the companies are cooperating with one another. So just anticipating a little bit, that case does not actually require authenticated use. Any kind of gated thing or stuff like that would all be consistent with it, because presumably the company that is being acquired is cooperating in the due diligence, and if not, then maybe you've got a problem in your mergers and acquisitions department. Whereas in the case of expert witnesses and so on, it seems to me the conditions are very different. That's a case where somebody's trying to find things out without necessarily having the cooperation of all the parties involved in the dispute. So in the mergers case, presumably, you could anticipate that some sort of token or something could be offered from the to be acquired to the acquiring company, whereas in the case of the expert testimony, it's perhaps unlikely that the expert would be able to access that unless there were a court order or something like that. So I would want to make a distinction there. Thanks.
Thanks. Okay. Is there any, are there any other questions? Chuck, should we move on? I see there's some chat stuff going on.
Yeah, there is. Hopefully everybody's watching the chat. This is Chuck, and take a look at the chat, and if it looks like questions are being asked and answered in the chat, interesting question was, do we need a use case for a new use case? Again, like I said, I think before we started this one, if somebody wants to prepare a new use case, just please present it to the working group by Friday, and hope and be on our call next week so we can discuss it. So just remember that. Is that Mike? Is that an old hand?
Oh, sorry, Chuck. Yes, I apologize.
No problem. We all do it. McGailey.
Thanks, Chuck. McKinney, for the record. They're just commenting on a couple of things here. I mean, I think the use cases are interesting, and somebody mentioned in the chat, and it's something we've definitely seen both as a registrar acting for our own clients, trying to help them to coordinate their domain portfolios, and as a registrar for the domains that, you know, have ended up with us through things. I mean, one of my own staff in a moment of wisdom, in large inverted commas, decided to register blackknight.solutions because he thought, quote-unquote, that it would be a good idea that the company should have the domain name. Of course, he failed to mention this to anybody and went off and registered it with a competing registrar and put Who Is Privacy on the domain name. That was, but then decided to host it on his own account with us internally. I didn't speak to the person directly, one of his managers did, because if I'd spoken to the person directly, it wouldn't have ended very well. But that this kind of thing does happen a lot. It's messy. Thanks.
Thanks, McKaylee. Are there any other questions or comments before we move on? Okay. While we're waiting to see Andrew's comment in the chat there, could you please bring up the use case number 18 by Elaine. She's now with us and ready to go over that. And we'll pause just a second here for everyone to read Andrew's comment in the chat. And then now that that's up, Elaine, you're up. Please give us an overview of this use case. And again, like with Beth, if you feel free to manage the hands raised and so forth directly so that I don't have to get in the way.
Okay. Can you hear me all right? Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, we can. You're a
yep.
little bit soft,
yeah.
but we can't hear you.
Okay. I will speak up. So my name is Elaine Fruis. I'm the VP of Operations at Donuts, and we manage 190-some new TLDs. And I've been in the industry for more than 15 years, so I've had experience with Whois in the new gTLD space, the old space, the CCs, obviously not public by contract the way the Gs are, but regardless, they've had Whois as well. So one of the ways that we use Whois in our company, and I know many other people do in other companies, not specifically registry operators, but anybody around the domain business, is to gain business intelligence. So that might be looking for a specific pattern of registrations. It might be trying to explain the run on number domains coming out of China. There's all sorts of bigger events that happen than a single company or a single registrant getting domain names, and we examine the WHOs in order to sort out what that might be. So I wrote up a sample business case. This is just one of many, many ways that WHOs is used by analysts, economists, researchers, marketing managers. In my WHOs use case, a market economist has been hired to review the impact and effect of a marketing program where a registry operator is giving away domain names for free. So you know, you might be interested in knowing if that cannibalized registrations and other TLDs, or did, you know, your usual domainer registrants run over to the free one and scoop up as many as they could before free was done. So it's, I don't need to read the use case to everyone, but generally it's just a matter of taking a look at bulk data, which can be accessed either through slow download of, you know, the public-facing WHOs, or a cooperative registry operator could pass that over to the analyst. So it's taking a look at that bulk data, looking for patterns, and trying to discern whether or not that program was effective in the way that it had been designed. So that's my summary. Does anybody have any questions about that particular use case or BI in general, business intelligence in general for WHOs?
Elaine, this is Chuck. Let me start it off, and hopefully others will jump in. This isn't something that would just be used by registries or registrars, but I assume it would be could be used by other businesses as well. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So any social media group might use WHOIS to look at, you know, who's active on the internet, who's selling things that have to do with shoes, who's, you know, just in general, it's a great resource of information to look for particular data to help advise marketing plans, you know, which market to enter. So you might have like a startup company that's trying to distribute some new app, looking at which domain registrants have similar types of product and how do they distribute.
Thank you very much, Elaine. Chuck. And note that Steve gives another example. Like you just said, there are uses by other businesses besides registries and registrars, and he gives a nice example in the chat if you haven't seen that. Go ahead, Andrew.
Oh, thanks. So what isn't clear to me from this case is whether the RDS itself is actually needed for this. So in particular, I'm wondering, and this might be just a friendly amendment, that actually making the distinction between the active content or parked or whatever and other uses is a little bit easier with the RDS, right? I mean, because you could evaluate that by just testing in the DNS, and then, you know, downloading the pages or connecting and sort of trying to map the services at a given domain name. So you could do most of this analysis actually without looking in the RDS today, but it might be a little bit harder, and so you might want to. I mean. Maybe this is just gilding the lily. I don't really care, but it strikes me that there is a possible argument here, at least for somebody who says, well, you don't need the RDS for this, and so you might want to talk about, you know, how that would be somewhat easier. Thanks.
Thanks, Andrew. So, yeah, I think a good case for how you couldn't expose some of this information via DNS would be, so DNS is great for looking at name servers, but you can't see the location of a registrant. So if you're trying to figure out which media market to launch a campaign in, you know where our domain buyers located. You know, you want to be very smart with your media spend. So by using the Whois and looking at the number of registrations in a particular city or zip code or state or country, you can make smarter decisions that way.
This is Chuck again. Are there any other questions or comments? Again, I assume everybody's watching the chat. Discussion going on there. Go ahead, McKaylee.
Thanks, McKaylee. I mean, as we've discussed previously, I don't think arguing against the use case, while interesting, it isn't really appropriate. I mean, we have to just accept this is a use case, this is what people do, whether we like it or dislike it. We can say, I suppose, that we don't like it, but kind of arguing against it isn't going to help us too much. I mean, we had this with around the CAs and a few other things. I'm not sure exactly how we thread that needle. But looking at, who is data, the way that Elaine's talking. I mean, it's an interesting idea, but surely you then end up with a huge number of domain names that are registered in Arizona and a few other places where there are Whois privacy proxy services that are going to completely skew your results. I mean, I don't see how is doing that going to help you? I'm just a bit confused by that.
Yep, that's true. So, of course, the privacy and proxy data wouldn't help inform the location of a particular registrant, but that's generally about 20% of registrations in the new TLDs anyway, so you've still got a pretty significant sample size.
Any other questions or comments for Elaine? Okay. Again, we'll watch the chat. Why don't we bring up the next use case for Marina, the business domain names. And in the meantime, everybody can watch the chat and see what's going on there. And Marina's on audio only, so I will watch the Adobe for you, Marina, and once we get to questions and answers, assist you on that.
Cool. Super. Thanks, Jack. Marina Lewis, for the record, and I apologize in advance to all. I hope you can hear me okay, hear me clearly. Unfortunately, it's another Tuesday morning commute in San Francisco Bay Area, and I'm still on the road, so I will try to speak quickly and loudly, but if there are any problems, please let me know. So the use case that I drafted is for a domain name acquisition within the context of a bankruptcy proceeding. And I chose bankruptcy proceeding for a couple of reasons. One, because this exact situation actually happened to me in real life a few years ago with very interesting consequences that I will share with you momentarily. So it certainly was good to talk about what I know. And second of all, I chose it because a bankruptcy situation is unique to other types of acquisitions or transactions, including the one that Beth described a few minutes ago, in that in the course of a bankruptcy proceeding or a transaction that's taking place, you generally don't have parties who are cooperating. In fact, one half of the negotiating side is usually either non-existent or fired or laid off or in jail. So you can't really rely on the other side to give you information that is necessarily accurate or complete. So I will just go over really quickly here the facts that I've listed in the use case. And this is a situation where a company wishes to purchase assets from a bankruptcy trustee, from a now defunct company that has filed bankruptcy. And so again, I am making a distinction where you're acquiring assets as opposed to the entity itself. So again, you've got no staff, there are no employees or anybody else really left at the company who can speak to the accuracy of the assets and their validity. And in fact, in the case that I dealt with, we didn't have anybody from the bankrupt company. We had only kind of a very surly bankruptcy trustee who really didn't like me calling any more than I needed to. So what this does is this puts the onus on the acquiring company to do their homework and to really check out assets such as patents, trademarks, real estate, other types of assets, to make sure that there is, one, a clear chain of title, that this trustee or this bankrupt company has actually some asset to sell, and also to make sure that the asset itself is still living and valid, which again, in this case was rather interesting. In a nutshell, my client had sought to purchase assets, including trademarks and copyrights, and four domain names from a company that was defunct. And in our situation, unfortunately, they listed out the assets, including the four domain names, but because so much time had wound through the bankruptcy proceeding, been shifted back and forth between different lawyers, by the time it got to our plate, the client has already, or at least specifically to mine, the client has already signed off on everything, and the domain name had expired 2 months prior. And that's because nobody at the bankrupt company had bothered to renew the domain name prior to the sale of the assets. So I had to dive in and quickly, first of all, see what was going on with these domain names. And I ended up having to spend a year trying to convince the registrar that we did indeed have a bill of sale, that there was actually a legitimate transfer of assets. But in an ideal world, this could happen differently if you have information available up front. Now, again, in my situation, had I been able to do this, this is the use case is how I would have liked to have seen it turn out. You get domain names, you go and you check the RDS, which is our who is. I want to verify, first of all, that the person selling the asset actually has title to the asset itself. In other words, are you the registrant or is this somebody else from your organization? And two, what is the status of the domain name? Is it in a pending delete status? I mean, most of the people on my own team or the people that the corporate lawyers who had handled it really before my firm, nobody knew to look for any of this. If you'd said pending delete status to them, they just would have given you deer in headlights. I mean, again, many lawyers don't know what that is. So it's important to be able to have access to that kind of information so that I can check and make sure that my client is actually getting the benefit of their bargain, which in this case, they essentially paid money for a domain name that was no good. I mean, it was expired by the time they ever got it. And again, by the time it got to my desk, it was already past the redemption period, and somebody else had actually renewed the domain name. So we ended up having to put a snap on it and wait a year and pay more money to get it on a back order. So I guess the point that I want to make from this is that if we look at domain name registrations as legitimate, intangible assets to be bought and sold, and many courts in many jurisdictions have found that they are, and many of the people on this working group would agree that they do constitute legitimate assets. And again, we can agree or disagree in terms of domain investing or whether somebody's reselling it. We can agree or not. But if they're going to be treated as assets, then we should treat them as assets. And that means that we need to have information available so I can, one, do a title search. It's no different than if I were selling a piece of real property, I would hire a title company to make sure that the seller has actual clean title to the property and can sell it to me. And two, I want to make sure there are no encumbrances or there are other types of, action items due. For instance, a renewal date. I would be willing to take a poll and see how many corporate lawyers actually know that domain names expire. I wouldn't expect them to know that. That's not what they do. That's what we do. So, again, it's important to be able to have access to that information if we're going to treat domain names as assets, which, again, means that we need to have access to registrar data. We need to have access to expiration dates and term limits. So I welcome any questions or comments.
Thank you very much, Marina. So it's now open for questions and comments. And again, I'll manage the queue since Marina's not in Adobe. please raise your hand, and then I'll read any comments in the chat related to this use case as well.
Awesome. Thanks, Jack.
Richard Padilla is typing, he's just responding to a comment that Michaela made about spam.
My horror story was just obviously so impactful that everybody agrees with me, and there's no dispute, so this is awesome. Beware the trials of which I have warned ye.
Any questions or comments on this use case? I'll pause. This is Chuck again, and I'll pause just to see if there are any. Feel free to jump in if you have any questions or comments. Nice job on writing up the use case, Marina, and in presenting it to us. Mike Pelage says, I agree with Marina and can attest to similar problems involving bankruptcy cases. And Vicki Scheckler says, I agree with the general principle that we should consider the domain an asset.
You know, I'll just respond really quickly, and thank you guys both for your comments. As to Victoria's comment, I do want to say I won't necessarily take a position in this use case, or I should say more specifically, the purpose of this use case was not to take a particular position on whether or not domain name registration should or should not be assets. Rather, I'm taking the position that because the from what I can see in terms of the industry, the law, user experiences, people seem to be treating them as assets, and therefore, because people are treating them as assets, I think that, or I should say rather, people consider them to be assets, we should therefore treat them as assets and provide the necessary infrastructure and directory service to be able to verify the value and the status of that asset. So again, I appreciate the comments. I agree with both. I just wanted to finesse that a little bit.
This is Chuck again. Thanks, Marina. And VA is of the opinion that they are assets. Alan, you're up. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Marina actually said what I was going to say, but to elaborate just a little bit, we've recently had a case where there was a question whether a ccTLD was an asset or not. And essentially, we're in the same overall ballpark. And I think the answer is whether it is technically an asset in legal terms or not, since they are treated as something that can be sold and has value, then we have to acknowledge that. An asset normally, I think, although I may be wrong, is technically owned. Clearly, domain names are not owned in that context because they're effectively leased. But regardless, they're treated as assets by bankruptcy administrators, if no one else. Therefore, we can't ignore that fact. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Make sure if you're not talking to mute your phones. Hearing quite a bit of background noise right now. Everyone, please mute your phones if you're not talking, and I'll turn it over to VA.
Yeah, hi. Thanks, Chuck. This is Vaibhav Agarwal for the record. Yes, domains are assets. There is a very big domaining industry. I work with a lot of venture capitalists, and I work with a lot of startups around the world, and we've noticed lately that there is an asset value in the balance sheets and the overall valuations of the companies of the digital assets that they own. And it's not just limited to the court orders or the court assessments anymore. The domain names, ccTLDs being part of that business's country business. For example, a global organization, Facebook, Fox Studios, everyone's in India, for example. Everyone has a .in, and that .in is considered to be an asset for them. You know, when they go to a particular region, they always have an asset-based domain name, which is again a ccTLD, besides the generic domain name. So it's definitely an asset, not just limited and limited to the court. It has to be treated, CCTLDs or GTLDs. It is absolutely part of the balance sheets and part of the overall valuations of the companies. As digital assets today, the virtual assets are actually treated as assets around the world. Thank you.
Thank you, VA. This is Chuck again. And Marina, I won't read all the chat because there's a lot of chat about whether it's an asset or not, with quite a bit of support that it is, just like VA just said. But Jeff Eckhouse makes an interesting point. I think this working group should steer clear of whether it's an asset or not. And several people agreed with him on that. And it may be that it doesn't matter when we do our deliberations. We'll find out, I guess, when we get into deliberations, whether it's an asset or not. We may be able to do our deliberating. So we'll see as we move forward. Stephanie said, since ICANN in general has steered clear of that one, I don't see that we have any choice in the matter, hardly within our remit. Maxim said, do we see similar worldwide approach? And he doubts that. Lots of great chat. You may want to go back and look at the chat for this, Marina, when it's available for your particular use case. Alan, you're up again.
Thank you very much. I would strongly suggest we do not want to use the term asset or declare domain names an asset. If we do, we're in a situation where a court could decide against us and invalidate the other things that are in our recommendations and in the policy that ensues from it. If we say because it's an asset, such and such is true, and a court decides it is not an asset in some jurisdiction, we have a big problem. Stay clear of it. Thank you.
Good point, Alan. Thank you. Michaela, you're up.
It's Michaela for the record. One of those rare occasions where Alan and I actually agree. I think if you look, the use case where a domain is treated as an asset is valid and is something that we should definitely look at, but we shouldn't be going down the path of getting into complicated discussions about whether a domain name is an asset or not. As others have pointed out, it's messy, it's complicated, and it's out of scope. I mean, who cares, realistically? For the purposes of this thing, we can say, look, some people treat them as assets, they do this, move on. Thanks.
Thank you, Michaela. And Stephanie says it's more like black holes. In response to Mike's comment that domain names are like light, dual characteristics of both a wave and particle. So again, the chat's really interesting, Marina. So please take a look at that when you can. And Stephanie comments that it was meant as a joke. All the physicists on the group need not respond. Okay.
Thanks,
and Maxim, I'll let you jump in just a second. Maxim says, should we recommend to add to implications might be limited to local legal practice? And go ahead and jump in, Marina.
Okay. Thanks so much, Chuck. I appreciate it. I actually just got to my desk because I'm logging on now, so I get to see all the great comments. I did want to respond again. People have made several comments about whether or not we should consider it an asset. And I appreciate that debate on the subject because, again, it's not something that has been settled one way or the other. Certainly in the United States, our courts are all over the map. Most seem to be coming down that it is an intangible asset. Many others haven't weighed in at all. And I do like Alan's comment. I think it was Alan that made the comment initially after I spoke. And, I agree in the sense that if they haven't been legally codified as assets, certainly many are treating them as assets, and so if nothing else, they are likely to be considered de facto. The point I want to raise, though, is because we're also getting some comments back as far as whether or not we should even consider the issue. Michaela says, come on, who cares? Some people do, some people don't. And again, I don't want to, stir the pie, stir the pie any more than I necessarily need to here, but I think that it is important and it is valuable to make the determination because this is philosophically
a big divide in what we do. I mean, there are people who, you've got the Phil Corwins of the world who say these are absolutely assets. There is a huge demeaning industry. People have, invested, millions, X, times whatever, amounts of money in resources in creating these domain portfolios. They are absolutely assets. And then we've also got a very vocal contingent that says, I don't know what their feeling necessarily is on assets, but they look at a domain name registration as sort of like a pseudo identity, and to shield a person, and all sorts of privacy concerns. So I feel like we sort of have a couple of different diverging viewpoints on this. And again, I'll just say from my own perspective, I'm not married to the idea that they have to be domain name assets. I've run into domain investors that I thought were unscrupulous, that did seek to engage in practices I didn't personally agree with. I don't know if I'm necessarily ready to throw out the baby with the proverbial bathwater and say, well, that's it, we can't have domaining and these are not assets. What I'm saying, though, is that if we are going to do that, if we are going to look at these as assets that are worth money, and they certainly are to many, many people and organizations, then that means that we need to be able to provide infrastructure and framework to evaluate the value of those assets just like we would any other asset. And that would seem to fly in the face of a lot of the folks who think that we should really be looking at this more from a privacy standpoint. You've got, Joe Blow out in, some country with an oppressive regime, and somebody's frog here. Some people argue that this person, needs to have a lot of privacy, that this, whatever some of the reasons we've had here. But they're not talking about asset ownership. They're talking about a person's identity. And to me, we do need to think about whether or not we look at domain names as assets, because I don't think you can have those two philosophical scenarios existing in the same universe. I mean, you're either in the public sphere or you're not. A domain name is either, I'm not sure how I'd really characterize it, but it's either, it's a sample of sort of like the digital public space, or it's something very private and tied to an individual. So, again, I don't want to necessarily muddy the waters to, so short before the end of our call. But the whole point of bringing this to people's attention is because I feel like we are going to be debating this much more because, as the old saying goes, with rights come responsibility. And if you want to be able to seek the monetary value of a domain name, I expect to be able to see information in that RDS that I can use to verify the legitimacy of that whatever it is, the domain name, the asset, however you want to classify it. Well, again, that's flying in the face of people who want privacy. So if there's going to be an issue with how we consider domain names, we should probably talk about it now, not 2 years down the road.
Thank you, Marina. Before I jump to the queue again with Rod and McKaylee, I want to just comment on something that VA said. He said, domaining is not part of the business here, but organizational ownership is. If you'll indulge me for a minute, I have to think back to the 90s when at Network Solutions, we desperately tried to even avoid using the term owner of a domain name. And, of course, it's all related to a lot of what we're talking about with regard to assets and so forth. So forgive me for indulging in that regression there, but let me jump to Rod.
Thanks, Chuck. Rod Rasmussen here. There is a really good chat going on. I decided to jump on the call instead of dumping on the chat, but this raises some really interesting stuff, and we didn't really get too much into this particular aspect in the EWG, so I'm finding this really interesting, and it really ties to what's the purpose of domain names, and that's what is the purpose of domain name registration data. But when you think about it, the purpose of domain names kind of drives the purpose for needing registration data around them to some extent. So I think it's actually an interesting discussion. I'd add a couple other purposes that have not been brought up because we have this system where you have what I would consider an asset like Google.com that's probably worth, I don't know, billions of dollars versus a throwaway domain name that somebody used in some advertising campaign, and they want it to cost like nothing, right? And so it's got almost no value, other than a transitive value at a time. And then you have domain names being used purely for internet infrastructure, for kind of the plumbing of the internet, as it were, that aren't tied to any intrinsic kind of commerce or trademark or anything like that, but they're important and necessary to make the whole system work. So, you know, how do you classify those? But again, you know, you have different needs for information around those kinds of domain names. Let's say it's being used for DNS servers or email infrastructure or something like that. I have a lot of need for potential technical contacts there versus if I'm doing an M&A or some sort of trademark dispute thing, I need ownership information. So the kind of the what how domains get used themselves drives what kind of information you might want to have around them. So it might be an interesting vector to kind of have a little crib sheet of or matrix of what different domain uses, the uses of domains themselves are to help make sure we've covered the various use cases and things like that. And, you know, one last final point is that assets are different in different jurisdictions in the physical real world, too. It depends on the laws of the country you're in as to what can be considered an asset or not, or whether even the state owns it or not. So there's a last thought there. Thanks.
Thanks, Rod. Michaela, you're up.
Thanks, Michaela, for the record. Need to bear in mind, you know, just because a group of people and organizations want to have access to a lot of data for it to be able to prove, quote-unquote, value, ownership, or other terms that they're comfortable with, that doesn't mean that that cannot coexist with a scenario whereby a lot of domain names don't have all of that information published to the public. I mean, the CCTLDs, in many cases, this problem years ago. Why it is so hard for people to realize that, you know, that it can be solved and that the two can coexist has always confused me. I mean, I take the case of, say, .fr. Blacknight.fr has public whois, which shows exactly which entity is registered to, and assuming the damn record is up to date, it should be my company. Whereas mnalen.fr, you won't find any details on that at all. I mean, you'll find the name servers, and the rest of the quote unquote public who is practically non-existent. Or the case of say .cat or .tel, which are two GTLDs, where they've managed to differentiate between them. So I mean, as Rod says, it comes back to what people are using the domains for, rather than what can or cannot be done in terms of how the data is displayed. So just think of this, that there's no reason why you cannot have the two side by side. If I, as a private individual, want to have quote-unquote privacy and not publish huge amounts of data, that's my choice. And if you, as a company, want to publish huge amounts of data, that's your choice. I just don't see why the two can't sit side by side. Thanks.
Thank you, Michaela. Just a ton of chat going on that I won't try and cover. This is Chuck speaking. And so quite a lively discussion there. But again, we don't need to resolve whether a domain name is an asset or not, or whether it's owned or rented or leased or whatever. There's been a lot of debate about those kind of things over the years, and I'm sure it will continue. Hopefully, it won't hamper our work going forward, and we'll see as we do go forward. Any other questions or comments on Marina's use case? Okay, then let's move on to the next use case, number 22. Find domains registered by miscreant, and Rod's going to give us an overview. And Rod, welcome to the call. Thank you for joining us. And you're in the Adobe. So after you give your overview, please feel free to manage the queue in terms of hand raise and so forth, so that I won't get in the way there. Go ahead, Rod.
Okay, thanks, Chuck. Rod Rasmussen again. So this use case is fairly straightforward and I think has been covered in other areas, so I haven't spent too much time on it, but the idea here is that you've got a domain that's been or you've got some information that's tied to some sort of miscreant, or it could be illegal or abusive or what have you, behavior that's going on, and you're trying to identify other domains that are there that maybe have been created or being managed by that same person or group or what have you, and so the idea here is that you take information that has been published that is that can be found to be unique to that individual or group. Typically, they don't put their own names in such instances, but we've had many cases where because they're using templates or software that generates things, and they have a credit card account that's tied to a particular name or something like that, they end up using the same information over and over again to register names, and that can. And I actually included in the email I sent that in as a recent case where we're tracking very successfully all the new domains that are being created and used for particular exploit sites by one particular group, and by a combination of looking at zone files and which is the DNS entries for a couple of the new TLDs that they happen to be abusing, and then their own registration information, which could be a street address tied to a city and a town that may or may not make sense. We're able to basically block all their infrastructure ahead of time and put together the whole package so that we're finding these things, and also. You can use this to build cases where you found some form of abuse. You might tie that to some profile online, and then be able to take other information tied to that profile, say an email address or different than information you have, and go back to the database or the data you have available and see if there's anything else that's tied there. So, it's similar to the trade market research case, except we're looking for abusive behavior or illegal behavior instead of, infringing marks, but same kind of idea where you're looking for those telltales. Typically, you've put this together as supporting evidence. It's not something that you would directly use in a court case necessarily. But you are able to then, monitor activities and things that are being done using those other domain names and take the appropriate action. That's pretty much it. Any questions on this, I'd be happy to discuss. Michele, you have your hand up?
Thanks. Yeah, does it say, Michele again for the record. It's interesting because we were dealing with this kind of issue from our side as the registrar of record because we were being targeted by, we don't know whether it was a single person or a group of people who kept on registering dodgy domains through us and trying to do all sorts of interesting things, mainly not paying us. In other words, using stolen credit cards or compromised PayPal accounts. But the problem we ran into was that it was a kind of a pattern that we found, not so much exact reusing the same details. So what I mean is that they would make the same mistake in every phone number, and they would use a similar pattern for the creation of a throwaway email address. In each instance, harder to track, but that was what we were kind of trying to do, is come up with a kind of a fingerprint to recognize them. Thanks.
Thanks, Michele. Anybody else? Yeah, I think people pretty much understand this one, Chuck, so I'll turn it back over to you.
Thanks, Rod. Appreciate it very much. Could we – I know that Rob is not on the call, or he wasn't earlier anyway, it doesn't look like he's on the call, so certainly not in Adobe. So could we bring up the examples? He didn't exactly present a use case, but rather shared some examples, and we've been having trouble connecting with Rob and getting him on a call. So I thought it might be helpful if we bring up his examples you should have the ability to control how large the font is, so make sure you use that and scroll yourself on this because you do have scroll control. I just wanted to open it up. I'm not going to go over his examples, but are there any of the examples that Rob shared quite some time ago now that anybody would like to discuss? That they're each one brief, just let us know which one you're looking at so that everybody can scroll to that. McKaylee.
Just McKaylee for the record. My email stopped working at the weekend one as well, I can totally relate to. And just very briefly, we've actually had this happen more than once, where they contact us saying, my email stopped working at the weekend. And when we look into it further, we discover that the domain had expired like 6 months earlier, but it took them until then to realize that it had stopped working, which always does make us laugh. But it is the cases he's kind of trying to outline there are the kinds of things that we see quite often. They're very, very common. People do things like they will register the domain name with one company, and then they host the website somewhere else, and they assume that the hosting and the domain name are the same thing. So they'll renew the domain, they renew the hosting for the domain, or they'll renew the domain, but they don't renew both. So if one breaks, then the other breaks. If anybody has any difficulty understanding some of these examples he's given as a registrar and a hosting provider, I'm more than happy to talk them through. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, McKaylee. That's helpful. And so notice that he was talking about example number one that Rob gave, and there are quite a few examples if you scroll down. Total of 9, I think. Again, I'll just pause for a minute or so just to give you a chance to glance at those if you haven't looked at them in a while and see if there are any questions or comments, whether there are any discussion on these. Okay. Well, then let's go on then, not sure what that is, but thankfully it went away. So this is Chuck speaking, and I don't think we have any other use cases that have been presented to the group. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. Although Olivier has suggested one in our email, I think earlier today, or at least I saw it earlier today, and so I'll say the same thing to all of you that I said to him. If there is one that you think would be useful, including a couple possibilities that Steve Metallet suggested in the chat today, all I would ask is that you prepare the use case following the template that everybody's been using and send it to the working group by the end of this week, so by Friday. And then we will discuss those. So we would like you to be on the call next week at this time and discuss those. If there are none presented, then we will move on in our work, and the leadership team will be providing some information on the agenda for next week, including any additional use cases that might be presented to us this week. So that said, so in other words, we will wrap up the current discussion of use cases next week. Again, if we discover one that's vital to our work down the road, we can still have a discussion of it. So next then is to talk about ICANN 57. Hopefully all of you have seen the doodle poll that was sent out yesterday. So there, on the first day of the ICANN meetings in Hyderabad, which is November 3rd, there will be two working groups, four-hour working group sessions, one by our working group and one for the subsequent procedures for new GTLDs working group. One will start at 9 a.m. and go to 1 p.m. local time, and the other one will start at 2 p.m. and go till 6 local time. So the other group has requested the afternoon session because one of their co-chairs isn't flying in until that morning. And the leadership team for our working group is just trying to see if there's really any significant difference either by in-person participants or remote participants. For those in the Americas time zones, the remote participation will be undesirable for either one, just for different groups, depending on whether you're towards the west or the east in the Americas. So I think there's about 20 people that have responded so far. We'd like as many as possible to respond so that we can see whether it really matters. I'm fine with accommodating the other working group and ours going in the morning. For those of us that will be seriously jet-lagged, it's probably better to not be in the afternoon where it really hits you. But at the same time, if it affects participation either in person or remotely, we'd like to get an indication of that. So so that we can make a decision on this, we're asking that everyone respond to the doodle poll by tomorrow. And then the leadership team will take a look at it and make a decision so that the schedule can be finalized and the other working group can plan accordingly as well. Does anyone have any questions in this regard or comments? Okay. All right, so please respond to the doodle poll by tomorrow, and then we'll take a look at the data and see if there are any significant advantages one way or the other based on those who are participating. We obviously can look at the membership in terms of geographic region, but that doesn't necessarily help us if people aren't planning to participate or if we don't know whether they're going to be in person or remote. So this poll will hopefully give some information. And it does. If it ended right now, it does give a little bit of information and that might be helpful to us in making a decision there. So, again, those of you who haven't participated, please do. We'll appreciate that very, very much. Our next meeting is next Tuesday at this same time, and the leadership team will be sending out an agenda on that meeting. We won't know any use cases to discuss until the end of the week, but we'll put a placeholder in there, and if they're not, we've already discussed the next steps according to pretty much what was decided by the working group in Helsinki. So you'll see that probably in the next couple of days, the planned agenda for that meeting, again, with a placeholder for any additional use cases that might come in. Is there anything else that I need to cover before we adjourn this meeting? And Lisa, by the way, sent her apologies. She's this week having to deal with some things that in support of her mom, but she is behind the scenes keeping up on things, so she'll hopefully be joining us next week. And she's still working on the triage work with Susan. Okay, not seeing anything else, I actually can give you 15 minutes or so back of this 90-minute meeting. Thanks for the great discussion, not only audibly but in the chat. It was really good, and hopefully everyone found that valuable. Have a good rest of the day and a good rest of the week. We'll talk again not only on the list but in our meeting next week. Meeting adjourned, and the recording can stop.
Great. Thank you so much. Again, the meeting's been adjourned. Operator, please stop the recordings. Disconnect all remaining lines. Everyone enjoy the remainder of your day.